Ryan L. from San Diego.
Thank you. My name is Brian. I'm an alcoholic.
Brian.
I want to thank Larry for asking me to share and congratulate Shannon, Jeffrey, and Brian on these milestones and everybody who received their 90 days and 30 days. You know, if you came here hoping to hear a well-polished and very articulate speaker, you're probably going to be disappointed. I'm just a drunk from Boston. You know, I started drinking at a typical age back home, you know, 11 or 12 years old. And I literally held on as humanly possible. And then why I picked up a drink, I have no idea. But I know why I continue to drink. And it's very clear in the book. You know, it was that effect produced by alcohol. I love the way it made me feel, how I interacted with people. My fears kind of disappeared, and I was off and running. I'm one of seven, and very early on, my father had mentioned, after me getting caught, you know, picked up for pest control and all these other things going on in my neighborhood, he said, "I don't know what it is about you, Brian, but you just seem to drink a little different than your brothers and sisters." I didn't think it was any big deal, but you know, I didn't have very many responsibilities at that age, so the collateral damage was minimal. You know, maybe miss a little school, maybe get suspended, kicked off the hockey team for a while. But all these things I just kind of minimized because they really didn't have a major impact on my life or whatever it was at that time. And, you know, right around 19 years old, 20 years old, the responsibilities kind of changed for me because my girlfriend had gotten pregnant. And, looking back, even at that time, I knew I was just absolutely incapable of the responsibility that was ahead of me. And I turned even more towards alcohol. I didn't know all this at the time, but it's just, that was a path. And, the trouble started immediately. You know, the night before I was getting married, my friends convinced my mother, of course I was living at home, it would be okay if I go out and have a couple of drinks and celebrate the inevitable. And my intentions, this is the God's honest truth, that my intentions that night, even at 20 years old, were I just wanted to go out and have a couple of drinks. I didn't realize that I had no control over what happened to me when I picked up that first drink. So I went down and went to the local bar and started drinking. And next thing you know, then the shots came. And then the blackout came. And I woke up the next morning, 9 o'clock in the morning. I was getting married at 11. And I had no idea who I was. I had not a clue where I was. I had to look at some mail. I was in an empty apartment. I looked at the mail on the table and realized that I was on a bus route close enough to get to my house. I immediately minimized what I had done, and I didn't even know that. Oh, no big deal. So, you know, I got to my house, and, you know, I was in some pretty serious trouble. I got married and went to the hotel that night, and about 3 o'clock in the morning, the fire alarm went off in the hotel, and I ran right out in the hallway. Didn't assist her out. You know, I just ran out on my own. And I had no clothes on. You know. And I'm looking out in the hall looking for, you know, a fire exit or whatever I was doing, and everybody starts coming out of their doors, and she just shut our door and locked it. And that was pretty much, unfortunately, that was pretty much as good as it got in a relationship with her, you know. One thing about my alcoholism, so we can laugh about these things, like I said. You know, looking back, every single relationship I had ever been in, whether it was just, you know, with my siblings, my parents, work, school, they're all affected by alcoholism, whether they drank or not, because I was an alcoholic tearing through their lives. And like it says, you know, it was the people that were closest to me that paid the highest price, starting right there with her, and then eventually my daughter. Because my daughter she's never seen me drink. But early on, all that says is I just wasn't around much because I was doing a lot of drinking. So, you know, it got to the point where, fast forward a few months, my brothers and I had a bar room, and I was, you know, coming and going as I pleased. And she grew up with an alcoholic father. And she saw the writing on the wall, and she approached me and gave me that ultimatum. And I'll remember this as if it was yesterday. She looked me in the eye and said, "Brian, you know, I can't go through this. It's either you're drinking and you're because I did other hors d'oeuvres, and your bar room and your little social life, or it's me and your daughter." And I looked her right in the eye and I said, "Don't make me make that decision because you'll lose." And she made that decision. And you know, I came home the next night and threw my coat over where the couch used to be, and you know, it was hell. You know, thank God for this process, because I was able to at least, you know, make the amends necessary. Otherwise, because if I was just stuck with, all right, now I don't drink anymore, and didn't process all that stuff, I'd still be, you know, a raging maniac. You know, Arthur, it's great to hear you. You know, when you talk about recovery, you know. I see this Yankees hat right there, and I've seen three this evening. I'm a diehard Red Sox fan. I haven't recovered from 2003 Aaron Boone's home run, you know. So it took me a long time to but what I have recovered since I got, so I got sober on June 1st of 2001. Things I definitely recovered are integrity, trust of myself and trust of other people. I've gained trust and been able to give trust. You know, some faith and motivation and, you know, a good direction. I've been put on a good path. But when I got sober in June of 2001, that was my first attempt at coming into AA. I'm one of the chosen few, because I came around here for 13 years before I ever stood and took a medallion. We call them medallions back here. But you know, so I spent a lot of time in early sobriety, and I just was, well, I know what it was. I wasn't willing to do what I needed to do. See, I just thought I drank too much. That was it. I didn't think I had any of those other defects that people were talking about in the book, which I never picked up. And, you know, there was some major wreckage. You know, aside from that, you know, I love my mother. You know, my parents are married a long, long time. And they got to witness all that pain and all that disappointment, and you know, in and out of the hospitals. You know, I was allergic to alcohol. I broke out in spots. It were typically handcuffs, horrible relationships, and hospitals. But everywhere I went, I had nothing to offer. I had nothing at all to offer. And my brother was sober a long time when he brought me to my first meeting. And, you know, I heard some things. And I saw the light in people's eyes. And I thought, you know, it's good. But it just wasn't for me. I was too young. You know, definitely too young. And you know, I still, you know, goodbye Rolling Stones, hello Lawrence Welk. I just wasn't ready to cash in my chips yet, you know. Unfortunately for the people around me, they continued to pay that price. So my circle got very small, and I ended up in that very, very dark, lonely place. And, you know, my daughter's birthday is on May 29th, and on May 29th of 2001, I was renting a room. I was a union carpenter making a boatload of money, and I was paying about $400 a month for a rent, and I was 6 months behind in rent. It was just hard to make ends meet, you know. I had other things to take care of. And the woman that I was renting the room from, I went out on a three or four day twister, and I was doing things that you know, that I wasn't raised to do, you know. And as I walked in, and there's a we used to call it the crack shack. There was a little shack out in the backyard, and I was running around with my buddy at the time. He's sober now, and I said, "Just drop me off, dude. I'm done." Well, I wasn't done. I wasn't ready for a meeting. I went into that shack, and it was cooking hot, and I was sitting there, and I was ready to take my life. I had no idea how I was going to do it, because the only thing in there was a school desk, a little old school desk, and a rolled-up rug. So I had no idea how I was going to accomplish this. But But that despair and that guilt and shame and remorse, it was percolating out of me. I mean, I had nothing. I was a shell of a human being. And I sat out there for about an hour or two, and then I rolled into the house trying to sneak up the stairs to go to my room and come up with another plan, because I was very good at coming up with plans. And the woman saw me in the stairwell, and you know, she goes, "Oh my God, Brian." You know, when I moved in there, I was sober. And she saw me, she goes, "Brian, you need to get sober again. You know, you didn't even see your daughter on her birthday." Now, I had been told that by many people throughout my life. That meant a lot more to me. But, well, then again, at least at that time, I mean, every single person in my life had told me that. But I had selective hearing. I didn't want to hear it. But when she said it, it made sense that day. You know, so I went in my room, and I called the guy that I was working with and asked him to take me to a meeting. I said, "But could you please take me one out of town, because I don't want to see all my friends around here and have them ask me that question. You know, how you doing?" You know, because I wasn't doing good. Well, in reality, I guess I was doing better than I thought, because I was ready to take my life, and now I had taken a step of faith and hope walking into a meeting. And they say when the student's ready, the teacher will appear. And a gentleman that I was familiar with around meetings, I asked him if he'd help me out, you know, because I was dying. And he said, "Yeah, under a couple of conditions, that we also go through the traditions, and we also go through the 12 concept of world service." And I was like, "Yeah, whatever, dude. No, I need help." So we sat down. He qualified me as an alcoholic. You know, he told me about himself, and he asked me about me. You know, steps 1 and 2, he said, are just about reflection. You know, I don't have to come up with anything new. Just kind of take a look at where you're at. And he said, "Now, as we read through this process, we're reading through the, you know, first step work." Well, first of all, he opened up the big book and he said, "All right, now read what's on page 1. And I said, "Well, there's nothing on page 1. He said, "Exactly. That's what you know about staying sober." So, you know, all right. And I didn't know how it was going to work, but I was willing. So every week or a couple days a week, I'd go over to his house. We'd sit there. He'd been sober a long time. His wife was sober a long time. And you know, he started walking me through that book like a baby, because I just couldn't grasp it. And he used his experience to do that. And he said, "Brian, I want to tell you something." He goes, "You don't have to go through the steps." And I thought he felt the same the way that I did, that I just drank a little too much and I didn't have all these other problems. That isn't what he was saying. He said, "But you deserve to go through the steps. And your family deserves you to go through the steps. The people you haven't even met deserve you as a self-admitted alcoholic to go through the steps." And he said, I said, "All right." And he said, "So what in the past you think has been your problem?" I think he already knew it, but he wanted me to kind of tell him. I said, "You know, I just didn't do any work. I just did this, and I go to meetings, and I had no higher power. I didn't get sponsors. I didn't do any service." He said, "All right." He said, "Well," he goes, "for me, anyway," he said, "the way that it works," he said, "Brian, when you remove alcohol out of your life, I remove the most important and the powerful and influential piece out of my life like that." He said, "Until you replace it with something of equal or greater value, you're going to suffer. You're not going to struggle. You're not going to have a hard time, but you're going to suffer. And the people around you are going to suffer even more." I said, "Well, okay." I said, "What are you replacing it with?" He said, "Take a look at the triangle. Unite, recover, and serve. You put those in proportion into your life. The better proportion they are, the easier time you'll have dealing with yourself. Because ultimately, it's all about me. It's about my perception of things." You know? Perfect example of that, Valerie and I, back in Massachusetts, we lived just off of I head off to work the same way, about the same, I had a little bit of OCD, so it's the same time, I got to go stop at Dunkin' Donuts, get my coffee. One particular morning, I go up, and I'm getting ready to pull in, a guy pulls out, right in front of me. And it didn't even bother me, I didn't even notice it. I'm like, "Oh, okay, let him go." So, go through my day, The very next day, the same guy at the same time pulls out right in front of me again. And I just lost it, you know. It's like, this dude's trying to get over on me, you know. And it's the exact same situation. I just responded differently. Because it depends on where I am spiritually is how am I going to respond to a situation. Of course, I didn't know any of that at the time. I was trying to follow him up the highway, you know. But that's what it is. You know, I had to first find what the problem is. The problem is, you know, I was an alcoholic. I was just an alcoholic. I was a number of other things, too, but I'm an alcoholic. And simply taking alcohol out of the equation just didn't work for me. So I needed to get that balance in my life, and I was finally willing to do it. So he told me, as far as the first step writing, you know, there's not all that much out of the book. He said, but take a look at, you know, I didn't mix milk with whiskey and all that stuff. He said, but take a look at some examples in your life and write them down in your book of maybe when you picked up a drink and for some reason you had no control over what happened afterwards, that powerlessness. And because of that, write some examples of the unmanageability that happened because of that. So that I could kind of identify with that. I could put it into I didn't have to listen to somebody else. If it made sense in here, then I was going to have a better chance at understanding it. So I did that, you know, and that night before my wedding was one. And there was many others that are just burned into my memory. And so then we get to, you know, we move on, we get to the second step. And he said, what's your relationship with God? Now, he was a Jewish man, and I was a non-practicing Catholic. I had no idea how this, another hurdle. But I said, it's not good, it's terrible, I don't like him. I actually have some resentments towards him. My daughter was born with developmentally disabled. I blamed God on all. I blamed God for everything. Took credit for everything good in my life. But I blamed God for everything that wasn't good. And he said, okay. He said, so how can you be angry at a God that you don't even believe in? First of all, and I didn't obviously have an answer for that. He said, sounds like there's room for improvement. So he kind of minimized that, because I was ready to take that conversation and run three more hours on it. You know, but he said, all right. So he kind of instilled a little bit of hope. And, you know, that the way that process worked for me is I came in here that hopeless, helpless alcoholic, and then I got a little bit of hope, which led me to make that first call. Then to sit down with this gentleman. And that hope turned into faith. And that faith over time has turned into, and you talked about how, you know, steps two and steps three evolve over time. That faith turned into trust. You know, that's kind of where I'm at now. And I didn't realize this, but he was the first man that I've ever, first person that I've ever trusted in my life, including myself. I didn't realize this till years later. So I said, okay, so I can pick anything I want, you know, because he reminded me of the God that I was raised with, that I formed with a child like mine. So now I had the opportunity to kind of pick and choose what I wanted to do, which I liked because I like having a little control. So I started doing that. I started, you know, opening my mind. He said, the only thing that's going to stop you from going forward, and it talks about it later on in the book, is my belligerent denial. You know, me closing my mind and just shutting off like I'd done for 13 years prior to. So I knew where that was going to lead me. So we get to step three, and he asked me, all right, so, Brian, there's three frogs on a log. And I'm looking at the book, and I'm like, I must be on the wrong page. I don't see that anywhere, you know. But he really had to simplify it. He had to simplify things for me in layman's terms. He was a well-educated. I mean, I studied spherical trigonometry. I'm not bragging about that because the trip I took here kind of took care of all that. I need a GPS just to get over here. And I live down the road. So he said, there's three frogs on the log, and two of them make a decision to jump in the water. How many are left on the log? And, you know, I sat there probably 10 or 15 seconds and, you know, moving around, you know, up here, let the rats chew on the wires and process that. And I said, well, there's one. You know, he said, no, there's still three. They only made a decision. Right? I make decisions all day long. Make a decision to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. At 5 o'clock in the morning, I'll make another decision that I'm going to get up at 5:30, you know? No? It's only when I act upon the decision that it has any result. And I didn't know obviously I didn't know these things. So I was like, okay. He said, so, I said, what do you do? He said, now we set out on this course. He said, so, you know, what is your will in your life? And I'm like, I don't know. I just say it, and I'll say it because everybody else says it, you know? He said, do you ever look at it like your will is the way that you think and the life is the way that you live? I said, yeah, that makes sense. He said, do you want to change the way that you think and the way that you live? I said, yeah. He says, good. Okay. Now we're going to formally take step three. Now, we didn't do the third step prayer out of the book. We did a different one, and I have one that my wife and I use every morning that we pray. And you know, that was the process. You know, all of a sudden I started getting a little bit of hope. And he started explaining things like, there's promises after every step in the book, Brian. I didn't know that, you know. He said, Bill's story, 16 pages long. First 8 pages are what it was like, and second 8 pages are what it was like afterwards. I'm like, I didn't know. I could read that 100 times and not figure that out. You know? I probably had. Then it came that fourth step part, and I never had a lot of fear about writing that. I was lazy. But this is all stuff I had already done. It was no surprise to me. I wasn't going to find anything in there that I was writing that, you know, kind of blew me away. But he did say, be thorough, you know, be honest. And after you're doing your writing, for me, it was like, he suggested, well, he told me what he did. He goes, I didn't have set times, and I didn't do it right before I went to bed. And any time I did my writing, I always made sure I did something to counteract, because it's going to stir some things up. So I did something more positive, whether I was going to help somebody or I was going to read something positive, but I didn't just kind of run out the door or try to lay down the bed. So that's what I tried. And it didn't take me long to write it, because that was just circulating around right up in here anyway. So, you know, I sat down with him with that list, and I hadn't gained all that trust with him at this point, so I had things written in hieroglyphics on his side, you know. And he asked me those questions at the end, you know. Have you left anything out? Nope. Try to make mortar without sand. Oh, no, we're good, you know, we're good. It's great. I went home, and I couldn't sleep. I was so full of anxiety, because I knew the couple things that I left out, and there were harms done to other people. That if I didn't hook back up with him, that I absolutely would have drank. You know, it was just, I knew it. So I called him up the next day. We met. He said, you know, he was available immediately, but my schedule work-wise didn't allow that. So I met with him within a, I don't know, 24 or 48 hours, and I got those out, and it was one of the most freeing things. And obviously it's right there in the fifth step, you know. That fear just left me. I could look the world in the eye. I'd never, ever been able to do that before. But to me, that is the promise that I feel every single day. Because I used to try to just add all these things. I come in, go to meetings. Okay, let's get some spirituality. Let's pray. I'll go anywhere and meditate. I go to retreats. And do all these things. And add them onto what? I was adding them onto the junk that I never got rid of. So it was just like that little whack-a-mole at the fair, you know? You know, you get two little rubber mallets, and this little gopher starts popping up, and you're banging them down, and that's what was going on with me for years. I wasn't getting rid of this stuff. All I was doing was covering it up. So it was only when I got rid of that that I fully experienced that fifth step. And it was amazing, you know? And it changed my life, you know? And then 6 and 7, I hooked back up with God, and you know, I say this all the time when I speak. What little I know about humility, I'm damn proud of, you know. I've got a huge problem with that, you know. But I did that to the best of my ability. I sat down with that list that I had already formed, and then I got ready to make those amends. I didn't walk right out and do them. I didn't go out and do them on my own. I made amends according to kind of prioritize. I didn't go out and make amends directly to my ex and to my daughter and to my parents immediately. For me, maybe some other people did, but for me, he had me start with some of the ones that weren't as emotional to me and to them. and kind of get a little feel for how this was going to go. Now, there's many people back there would rather see me dead than sober, and I knew enough where I shouldn't be, you know. So, you know, I remember when I made amends with my father a couple of years. I was 2 years sober. And we got a call. They wintered down in Florida, and he was in bad shape and didn't think he was going to make it through a couple of days. And me and my two brothers jumped on a plane, and they got there, you know, that night, and I got there the next morning. Because I had to go over and sit down with my sponsor, you know, and I sat down with him, and I was just a wreck, you know. We went over this whole thing, and I busted out the writing, and I went down, and, you know, thank God, you know, they kind of got things under control. He's got some major health issues, but him and I being early risers, we get up one morning after they kind of let him out of the hospital after a little bit, and we went down to the canal about 5 o'clock in the morning, and I made an amends to my father that changed our relationship. Absolutely changed our relationship and changed the way that I viewed him. Apparently the way that he viewed me. Because these are parents that would lock the door. Change the lock on the door when I picked up a drink. I'd get a call. I thought of this earlier. I got a call from my mother one time saying, hey, we're having a party for Paul on Saturday. I'm like, oh, great. What time? She goes, oh, no, I'm letting you know because we don't want you to come by. So, yeah. Yeah. But that same mother, a couple years sober, Valerie and I were over on a Sunday having dinner, and she had tears in her eyes, and she said, I think it was 3 years sober or so, and she said, I can finally go to sleep at night knowing you're going to be okay. I had no idea I was doing that type of damage because I'm a selfish alcoholic, you know. But, and then comes those 10, 11, and 12. You know, my sponsor said, 10 isn't, Brian, 10 isn't sitting home at night writing down your list. I walked around for years with a pad of paper and a pencil because he said, you know, you take this during the process, you know. I was having a lot of problems at that time with patience and tolerance with other people, which still can be an issue. So he said, all right, so, you know, pray for patience and tolerance. That's the obvious, you know, response. And I was coming back from our home group meeting on a Tuesday night, and it was foggy, very foggy out, and I was just moments away from home. And the road is about to turn into two lanes, and I'm going left to get down to my house. And this car in front of me in a 45-mile-an-hour zone is doing like 15, and I've just had enough. And I'm like, oh, my God. I said, it doesn't matter which lane they get in, because even if I won't go left. If they get in the left lane, I'm getting in the right lane, just so I can pull up next to them and buzz down the window and just give them that look for me. It's just that alcoholic, what are you doing look. So she gets, the car gets in the right lane, and I'm like, oh, great. Now I'm taking a left anyway. So I pulled up, and I put down the window, and there's this little nun clung. She can't see 8 feet in front of her. And I just, as I looked at her, I knew. I was like, whoa. Got it. I got the message, right? Got the message. And I thought about that all, I think about that all the time because it had such an impact on me at that time because I was willing to hear these things. So, you know, one of the greatest joys for me is the connection I have with God, and I heard Arthur say it earlier, you know, the closer I am to God, the less those things are going to bother me. Just like that guy that pulled out to me 2 different days. Exact same thing. But for some reason, I wasn't so self-absorbed that it was all about me. So that's why I continue to do, you know, 11 step. I have a power that I absolutely trust, that I trust when I turn to, that I can make that connection. I'm altered by company I keep. You know, I get to pick and choose who I had no choice before. I went wherever the drink and drug told me to go. You know? Now I get to hang out with, you know, pretty cool people. Well, Larry, you know, starting to become. I'll hang out with one of my craziest friends from Massachusetts tomorrow because we're no good watching a Patriots game in public, so we have to watch it literally in his house. You know, some things don't change, you know. But, you know, last year, my oldest brother was battling cancer. And, you know, last August, I went back to Massachusetts for a couple of reasons, but that was definitely one of them. And, you know, I got to go back there and spend 6 months back there as he went through this. I transferred work and got to spend some time with him, a brother who I had made amends with. And I had something to offer, as opposed to me going there just like any other time in my life. It always had to come about me and what was going on. Oh, my back, so what? I was able to just go there unselfishly and just be there. Some days it was just sitting with them, you know. And that was impossible for me as an alcoholic. I would not have anything like that to offer anybody, you know, because my grandfather, who lived with us for probably the last 20 years of his life, he was the biggest figure in my life. And he was home with hospice, and at the time I was out and about on my own, and my family was trying to get a hold of me because they wanted me to be there, because everybody said he's waiting for you, he's waiting for you. I'm like, well, what am I, the Grim Reaper? If he's waiting for me, I'm not coming up. And my brother actually came down and literally grabbed me and said, listen, you know, you selfish SOB, you get up there and be part of your family. And I went up there and, the whole house was full of people, you know, my cousins, my aunt, my mother, I mean, very active family. And, I was sitting there. Now I'm alone in the room with him. And, I mean, I'm no good alone anyway. And I was an absolute wreck. And all of a sudden, I'm reading him this book that he used to read me as a kid. It was Four Horsemen. It was about the four Notre Dame coaches. It was a childhood book, you know. But all of a sudden, he just squeezed my hand. He took that last breath, and I just flipped out. You know, I didn't know what to do. I went and woke my sister up. Then, you know, eventually woke my father up, and determined to wake my mother up. It was her father. And everybody comes into the room, and everybody's weeping but me. Because alcohol had robbed even just that raw emotion of feeling that. I mean, that's a pretty powerful disease, you know. So to be able to go back and be part of what I was able to do with my family was a blessing, absolute blessing, you know, to be part of that. Because it wasn't about me. It was just about me being a brother and me being a son and me, you know, me being back there to do what just normal people do, you know. So, you know, what do I do in my life today? I enjoy it. You know, I was about 9 months sober, and I walked into a meeting down in a basement in back of Massachusetts, and a bunch of, you know, old guys were talking about gratitude. And, of course, I had to throw my hand up because I had to tell them about this new wave gratitude that, you know, was going on. And after the meeting, I went upstairs, I lit up a cigarette, and I waited for everybody to come up and shake my hand. And this guy came up, he goes, Brian, right? I said, yeah. He goes, grateful? I said, oh, yeah. He said, why don't you get the hell downstairs and put your chair away? Because gratitude's an action word. I don't know whether to hit him or hug him. I'm like, but I've never forgotten that, and that's what it is. You know, I never look down at an alcoholic. You know, I've been there. I've been that one reaching his hand up. You know, I am responsible. My sponsor laid this stuff out pretty clear. The first time he heard me speak, and I spoke before a break. And then at break, he come over to me, and I thought he was going to pat me on the back, and he said, come over here. And he said, what the hell was that? I goes, my experience, strength, and hope. He says, no. Dropping F-bombs all over the place. He said, that's not who you are. That's not the guy that sat across from my table for years. He goes, it's not about you, Brian. Your job at an open AA meeting is this, is to try to connect with the alcoholic who still suffers, that new person out there who might be struggling, who might have come in and out and had all these problems, and then make yourself accessible to them. It's not about what you talked about. So I try to change that. You know? Life for me has been simplified. You know? I love the life I have. You know? My wife and I are on a good path. and both in recovery. I've got family members that are just struggling and being torn apart by this god-awful disease, but there's only so much I can do. And number one is just to be a power of example. They see what happens. We were at a family function years ago, and my aunt had taken old 8mm films and put them onto, at the time, VCR. I don't know if anybody, or maybe some people don't know what a VCR is, but... and we're sitting there as a family, and it's back in a park back in Boston, and everybody's out having a good time, and I'm in this little stroller, and I had like white hair. They call me Bam Bam. I'm like 2 years old, and this hand, everybody's smoking cigarettes, and my father's hand comes into the picture, and he's got a can of Schlitz, and he starts. My feet and hands are going, and I'm cranking down on that, and the camera pans away to everybody else doing their thing. And as it pans back to me, he's pulling it away from me, and I start throwing a fit. Right? And my aunt, whose house this was, who did that, she goes, "Things didn't change much after that, Brian. Anybody try to take your booze away, you threw a fit." But it was the truth. I mean, I defended my right to drink right up to the end, right up to the point where I was ready to take my own life in order to prove myself right. That, I spent so many years trying to change my life by thinking. It's by the action that changes the way that I think now. I used to think if I did this, that would work, but I never took any action. So now by taking the process, and believe me, I'm not perfect, I'm not by no means perfect. I can still get into my little moods, but to be able to be comfortable in my own skin and be able to have the people in my life and genuinely care about people and not be so just self-absorbed is not a life I thought this alcoholic was ever capable of having. I had no problem. I didn't mind the gunfights and rock fights and stick fights and knife fights. I thrived on that stuff. That's where I grew up. I lived on the streets of Boston because I thought that was a good idea in the dead of winter. Like weather that's back there now, I had no problem doing that because I had lowered my standards and thought, I'm okay with this. Fighting over a heat grate above the subway in the dead of winter with my guys, That isn't the way that I live today, nor do I want it. But I totally understand that I could absolutely go back there if I stopped doing what I enjoy doing. And that's trying to create that balance, the fellowship part of it's huge, and I fully haven't immersed into the fellowship part of it. Well, I'm not going to blame it on my work. Well, I'll blame it on my work schedule, but that's not the truth. It's I haven't put my hand out. But I remember I was living, when I first got sober, living with a few guys, renting a beach house back in Massachusetts. And I was like 3 months sober, and I said, it was a Friday, and I'm like, I'm saying to myself, I'm going to drink it tonight. Tonight's tonight. Can't handle this. Had nothing going on, but I just couldn't handle whatever it was. And I'm like, hey, and I had no car, of course. So I say, give me a ride into town. I'm gonna go out drinking tonight. And my buddies, they didn't jump all over me. They said, we're gonna go to the airport meeting. We'll give you a ride there. Why don't you come over? We'll bring you over to the beginners meeting. And then after the beginners meeting, we'll take you downtown. You can do whatever you want. So I go over there and I go into the beginners meeting and I throw my hand up, of course, because I got to spit out all the knowledge I have, and I throw that out and I say, and the next SOB that tells me to keep coming, I'm going to knock his teeth down his throat, because I was very spiritual at this time, obviously. And everybody in the room said, keep coming. And I'm like, so then they said, hey, a couple of our buddies, so now there's a break. I'm like, all right, dude, look, get me out of here. He's like, no, a couple of our guys are coming down for they're putting on the meeting. And he's sticking around, he's telling me the names. And so I said, all right, so. Then after that, I said, all right, let's go. It was great to hear you guys. He said, we're going to bring it back to the house. We're going to play poker tonight. And I thought, I could always use a little extra dry good money. So I said, all right, we go back to the house. Now, I still in my mind, I'm going to go out drinking. But now, you know, it's getting, you know, 10 o'clock or whatever. Sitting next to my buddy Josh, who got sober a week after I did, he's still sober today, and he puts his arm around my head, puts me in a headlock, and points up to the clock, and it was midnight. He said, oh, my God. He said, dude, you made it through a day when you thought the only option for you to pick up a drink was to pick up a drink, because you're a miracle. And that's the truth. That's where the fellowship part of this carried me, so I could find a strength and power that was going to help me move forward. So you know, I'm just cutting myself short. So this is my desperate attempt to reach out for fellowship part of it. But the direction, you know, the path I'm on in my life is good. You know, I mean, I don't know where I'm going, but I know I'm not lost, and that is completely opposite where I was before. You know, I always thought I knew what was going on, and I had no clue as to how inept I was at taking care of just daily business, suiting up, being a man, going to work, taking care of what I need to take care of, and being grateful for the things I have in my life and not, you know, complain about the things I don't have. You know, we moved out here from a 3,500 square foot house. I think I can almost touch the walls in the place I'm in now, and I love it. You know, it's not about what I have. It's about how grateful I am for what I have. You know, I'm looking at the vision for you, and that had such a major impact in my life, you know. Is, you know, basically I had to trust God, which I didn't have one when I walked in there. I had a clean house, my house, and I had to bring it forward, you know. And that's not just the people in the halls. That's the people I work with. That's people in my family. And that's for people that I'm going to meet standing in the coffee line, you know, because if I'm not spiritually fit and they're ordering 15 macchiatos, I'm not in a good place because I got to go, you know. So, you know, I was incapable of showing any gratitude in my life, you know. And for many years, all I could do was just stumble aimlessly through that path that I was on. And, you know, when I look at it, you know, I can't give any thought when somebody asks me, I can't spend 5 seconds thinking about what I'm going to talk about, because by the time I go from the chair to here, it's gone, because it's like a truth stick that just kind of straightens you out, for me at least, up here. And you know, like Valerie says, you just be honest, you know, you speak from your heart, because the people that I always identified with were the people who connected with me here, you know, about that, those broken relationships and the hope, you know. Because there's a guy that used to talk about, when I'd sit there, and I was speaking with this gentleman here before, you know, that It's what sitting down and doing step work with somebody is what they say I must not miss. You know, to see people like I was come in, and I knew what you had on your feet, but I had no idea what color eyes you were, because I had no self-worth. And to watch people be able to raise their eyes from their feet and watch them over time, and all of a sudden they're doing the deal. This guy Tim, back in our old group, passed away many years ago. He called it smiling eyes, you know. And to watch people, my sponsor said, hey, here's the thing, you know, if you don't know God, get to know his children, you know. And he told me a story about this lamplighter back in London, back in the days before they had electricity, where they go around, this guy's job was to go around the city and light the torches throughout the city. And you could sit up in the outskirts of town, and he never followed the same path. So that people would just sit up there and watch what he was doing. And I'm like, what has this got to do with, like, anything we're talking about? He said, just like here with God, you know, or somebody's higher power, you never know where they're going. But look around. You can see where he's been. Look at the people around. You can see who's walking the walk and talking the talk. Watch how they live their life. You know, it's all about how they live their life. And just like I could see where those torches are, and I see those smiling eyes all over the place, and those are the people I like to hang with. Thank you very much for asking me this question.